Dodlin, apostrophe, the final track on Horace Silver's 1954 album, Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers. It's a jazz standard. It has become one. The noted composer, arranger, and band leader is on piano. Hank Mobley is on tenor sax. Kenny Dorham on trumpet. Doug Watkins on bass. And Art Blakey on drums. Horace Silver, an undisputed defining force in jazz piano, died on June the 18th, 2014, at his home in New Rochelle, New York. He was 85 years old. But of course, everybody we highlight, the main thing is they made their mark before they left. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we're talking about history. Yes, exciting. Well, it ought to be, because I think that one of the most exciting things about Black history, especially, is that we have a new breed of historian, and they take their work so seriously. They literally pour themselves, whatever they have in terms of cash. They travel, they part historian, part archaeologist, part sociologist, part news reporter, part investigator, part all these disciplines they bring together in the course of doing their work. And I could think of no one more exemplary in this regard than Dr. Gerald Horn, who is with us today. He's one of the most prolific historian authors of our time. And we'll be talking about the role of history in a society, and in particular, whether history can be relied upon as a true and impartial account of anything. Dr. Horn's work, well, is closing in now on about 40 books and hundreds of articles and commentaries he's done. He relentlessly peels away the veneer of authenticity that mainstream history widely enjoys. Dr. Horn invests heavily as a scholar in presenting dimensions to historical issues and events that otherwise would let stand unchallenged the history is the story of the world's power elite model. He despises that model. He wants the record instead to reflect the full fight. And we are delighted, Gerald, that you could join us today and become a bit more philosophical than you usually are, because I really want to plumb your mind as a historian, which is one thing, but really as an analyst, a historical analyst, what is the state of affairs with history? And how do we, the ordinary folk, how do we relate to this body of study called history? Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, how about answering that first question? What is history? And should we have our guard up every time we read something that is said to be historical?
Well, I understand why there's the impulse to have your guard up when you read history in the United States, because, as you know, he who pays the piper gets to call the tune. And given the fact that so many historians are in the pay of those who have been indifferent at best to our plight, it's understandable why we are skeptical of the historical products that they produce. And let's set that aside for a moment and then turn to another problem, which is that, on the other hand, I do think that there are histories now being produced that are not, so to speak, trickling down to the rest of the population, they're basically conversations between and amongst historians. And I think that this is unfortunate. What, to be more concrete, there's a trend now developing that's really puncturing the creation myth of the founding of the United States of America as this beacon of liberty and freedom. And these revisions of history are now being constructed by historians in the mainstream, some who might be even seen as being at the apex of the profession. But alas, their narratives have not become popularized. They're not even popularized amongst those who could benefit from their being popularized. I'm thinking, for example, of two books in particular. There's this book by Alan Taylor, who may be the most celebrated historian now writing in North America, entitled American Revolutions, which does not go as far as I do in terms of puncturing the creation myth, but goes pretty far down that road. And I would say the same for a book by Robert Parkinson, The Common Cause, which also goes down that road. And the road I'm talking about is suggesting that what drove the founding of the United States was what any sentient being should realize instinctively and intuitively, which was a desire to steal the Native Americans' land and then stock the land with enslaved Africans. I mean, that helps to, of course, shed light on the current moment. I should also say it doesn't require that many leaps to go from there to the point of colonial settlement in North America in the first instance in the 1600s, and to see this process of colonial settlement as being driven by class collaboration between and amongst poor and richer Europeans against the interests of the rest of us. And it does not take an oracle to come to the conclusion that November 2016 and the election of one Donald J. Trump once again represents a kind of class collaboration between poor and now middle class and working class and elite Europeans against the interests not just of those of us residing in North America, but of against the interests of the entire planet. Now, even some of our friends on the left, because they have bought into the creation myth of the United States of America for whatever reason, have been making excuses and torturing the numbers to try to dismiss what is painfully obvious to the rest of us, which is that if you look at the 63 million who voted for Trump, all of those mathematically cannot be part of the 1% in a country of 330 million. But it's difficult to come to that painful reality, even by those who may think they don't have a stake in oppression, and therein lies the dilemma for the rest of us.
Now, this realization, slow as it is it because they finally are grappling with the demand of history, which is to tell the truth? Mm-hmm. Or is it that there is a thing called inevitability, and at least while they're still able to get in front of it, they are trying in so many different ways to alter their previous accountings and previous positions?
Difficult. I mean, to come to an accurate conclusion, I would have to interview these historians. I'd have to go through their correspondence and through their emails, which I'm not able to do at the time. But I do think that the call of truth may play a role. I do think that if you stand on the mountaintop from 30,000 feet, you may come to the realization that the United States is being left behind, that unless the 45th president blows up the planet, the destiny of this planet, at least in the short term, in this century, will be determined either in Beijing or in some sort of alliance between Japan and India. Now, if that's true and the United States is declining, then that may help to drive certain analysts into the United States to this understanding or realization that perhaps we need to understand why the United States is falling behind, why it's declining. And in order to come to that realization, then it seems to me you may have to go back into history. I mean, for example, I'm speaking to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where I gave a talk last night, and the talk was ostensibly on why Black lives don't matter. And in order to come to that, in order to answer that question, I had to not only look into the past, I had to look into the present. And so if you ask the right question, which is really the starting point for any sane and reasonable history, then it leads you, hopefully, to the right answers. Part of the problem in history is that people don't ask the right question. And if you don't ask the right question, it's very difficult to get the right answer.
But, you know, that brings me to the question of your consistency in the angle that you take and the interest that you take, the subjects that you tackle under the rubric of history. And that is, you look at the relationship, the power equation between the haves and have-nots. You look at the role of race and white supremacy. You look at exploitation. You look at colonialism. You look at imperialism. Why do these subjects have particular appeal to you?
Well, I, like many other people, I'm trying to figure out how we got to this point. I mean, for example, in 2018, it seems to me that even if you're a liberal, even if you may be a certain kind of conservative, you really need to ask yourself how we reached the precipice of fiasco and debacle in 2018 with this dangerous con man in the White House who may, in the maximal term, blow up planet Earth and leave, and in minimal terms will help to accelerate the decline of the United States of America. And in order to answer that question, you have to have an understanding of imperialism. You have to have an understanding of settler colonialism. You have to have an understanding of white supremacy and the cross-class collaboration and the between and amongst poor and richer Europeans that led to colonial settlement in the 1600s. And you have to understand the revolt against British rule that led to the formation of the United States of America circa 1776. And then you have to be transnational, because in order to understand settler revolts, it may help to look at the settler revolt in Rhodesia in November 1965 that ultimately led to the creation of Zimbabwe. You may need to look at the settler revolt in Algeria in the 1950s that for a while threatened the stability of the colonizing power that is France. So you have to understand, for example, the wealth that was generated through decades, if not centuries, of the African slave trade and how that helped to poison generations with the pseudo-intellectual rationales of white supremacy. So it seems to me, obviously, this is my point of view, that those are the issues we need to be tackling in order to understand the current moment, because, quite frankly, I think that even those, at least some of those, even in the U.S. ruling elite, are recognizing how perilous these times are with Mr. Trump in the White House.
But, you know, still in our minds and in the minds of most people, I would venture to say, history is not the present. History is the past, presented in the present. Is there any definitive turn in this basic assumption from the role, from the point of view of a historian, that history, you just said it, but I mean, why is it now undergoing such a drastic change that history is present, even future?
Elaborate on the point that you're making.
Well, when you pick up a book, usually, you know, and at least in my experience, you're about to read about an issue or an event of the past. You're not being prepared to appreciate what is happening in the present, nor are you being prepared to link the past to the present. It's two separate worlds. So you read about, as your book, 1776 book, for example, it breaks the rules, because what you're doing is not just history, it's investigative reporting that brings people up to the present in understanding the facts of how the United States declared independence. Was it really independence for everybody? That's not what people are accustomed to when we talk about history. We talk about, well, here's an event that occurred in 1776, and the whole thing is about that time. But you bring history straight up to the current time, and I wondered whether you are aware, I'm sure you are, of course, whether you are aware that in this one small tweak, you've made a dramatic change in attitude as a historian toward history.
Well, you know, obviously, I'm not the only person, I don't think, who's ever tried that approach, in all modesty. But in any case, I take your point, because too often historians, particularly in the United States, they throw up a great wall between the past and the present. As a matter of fact, you can be wrapped over the knuckles if you try to draw connections between the past and the present. The mainstream historians have a term for that, which they call presentism. You're not supposed to draw reasonable inferences about the past that shed light on the present. I recall a leading U.S. historian being interviewed on September 12, 2001, right after the attack on New York and Washington. He was being interviewed by his new book on Antietam, which was a major battle during the U.S. Civil War, which led to the realization in Washington that if they were to defeat the so-called Confederate States of America and their slave-owning mania, there would need to be a transformation. That is to say, they would need to move perhaps to an Emancipation Proclamation. Now, of course, they did not highlight the fact that, as ever, the white man's country faction that was fighting the Confederacy wanted to emancipate the Africans and then colonize them elsewhere. That is to say, ship us all overseas. But they helped to induce a dynamic that led to emancipation, then enlisting 200,000 black soldiers in the Union Army, which led to the defeat of the Confederate States of America. And that helped to induce changes in the United States that made it difficult to ship us all abroad to Brazil or Hispaniola or these other sites they had in store for us. And so this historian on September 12, 2001 was asked that in light of September 11th, might the United States have to make certain similar transformations and adjustments in order to deal with this present crisis? And he poo-pooed the question. He wasn't going there. Now, I understand to a certain degree, because he probably wasn't equipped to comment on Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden and all of that, because that leads to the second problem, which is that oftentimes historians' interests are very narrow and parochial. To put it in kind of absurdist terms, they study the manufacturing of blue shoelaces in 17th century France, and that's all they want to know about. And so they can't really draw any inferences that don't have a direct connection to blue shoelaces in 17th century France. So it's the narrowness of the training of historians that makes it difficult for them to draw connections between the present and the past. Some historians are quite proud of the fact that they don't really know that much about the present. And that's how you are trained. You're supposed to know about your subject and forget everything else, but I don't see how you can know about your subject without knowing about many other things. And ultimately, what it reminds me of, if you stay with me for a second, is of the trial of the police officers in the Rodney King beating case. What happened, as you recall, was that there was a tape of Rodney King being beaten, this black motorist in Southern California, 1990-1991. And what happened is that the defense team for the police officers, they would play a few seconds of the tape and ask the jury, do you see a problem there? And then they play a few other seconds and say, do you see a problem there? Rather than doing a continuous loop. And since the jury, which did not have any black people, may have been predisposed to acquit these officers, it was easier for them to come to a verdict of not guilty because, like contemporary historians, they were not making a continuous loop of that particular videotape, just like contemporary historians are not making a continuous loop of the past into the present. They're segmenting the past and disassociating it from the present, and that helps to make the products that they produce, the works that they produce, oftentimes less than adequate, and it then handicaps the rest of us in trying to understand the current moment, and then, perhaps even worse, it discredits the whole enterprise of historians and history in the minds of so many who need the lessons of history in order to dig ourselves out of the deep hole in which we find ourselves. Now, I hope that that long-winded explanation makes at least a bit of sense.
It does. This is Black History Month, and we see, I'm troubled by it, I must admit, a kind of knee-jerk reaction to just that phrase, Black History Month, where people decide that anything at all dealing with black folks is history. And even so, not necessarily a complete history, but just something. What, in your view, is the state of affairs with regard to black history?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, first of all, with regard to Black History Month, I mean, as you know, there are analogs. I mean, for example, there's Black August, for example, which focuses on the tremendous events that have happened to have occurred in August, the Haitian Revolution, August 1791, the Watts Revolt, August 1965. I mean, the list is very long. So I don't have a particular problem with the idea of focusing on a certain month and using that to highlight events that hopefully will be focused on all year. But having said that, I think that in some ways, black history and black historians more specifically are suffering from the fact that we are living in this paradoxical land of ideological backwardness for the time being, supplemented by mass affluence, at least affluence on the part of some. And what that means and what that suggests is that there are rewards and a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, if you like, for those who capitulate to ideological backwardness. Now, there's another issue too, which I've been thinking about quite a bit lately. And that is that right now as we speak, there is a real danger of war between Egypt and Ethiopia. And once you begin to look into that crisis, you can go back 5,000 years and recognize that a central premise in Cairo has been this paranoia about the source of the Nile River, which is seen as the lifeblood of Egypt, and has led to this mania to control not only Ethiopia, but the Horn of Africa. Now, as you know, we have many historians of the black experience who have specialized on the point of talking about the marvels of Egyptian civilization, ultimately stemming from the source of the Nile River in Ethiopia and points south. But I'm not sure if they're up to date on this present crisis that could explode at any minute, not least because Ethiopia is seeking to build a dam on its portion of the Nile River, which Egypt sees as a threat to Egypt's stability and security. Once again, that's a product of throwing up this great wall between the past and the present. And it may be, there may be other factors that perhaps I'm too tactful and diplomatic to mention in a public space, but it also speaks to the question that you're raising, which is whether Black history during Black History Month.
Well, there is an idea, and people readily accept it. You know, history is history, chemistry is chemistry, biology is biology, and so forth. And in that sense, each discipline is democratic. Everybody has access to it. Everybody has a way of, I've been talking from the professional point of view, the historian's point of view. There's nothing that prevents you from taking on a subject and doing a thorough job of it. Why is it that when it comes to matters historical relating to the African world, we don't see very much participation by white historians or by the white progressive historians? It seems as if the idea is, look, this is your neck of the woods. You guys handle it. We move on to something else. Do you find that this attitude is changing or becoming more and more prevalent?
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of historians who are defined as white who write about Black history. And some of the work is useful, and some of the work is not as useful. Part of the problem is that the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which I just made reference to, which I said was available to certain historians defined as Black, is available even more so to certain historians defined as white. And this makes it very difficult to write objective histories that will be of use to oppressed communities, because the U.S. ruling elite, as of now, and that may be on the verge of changing, and perhaps we can get into why that might be so, but as of now, that is really a handcuffing, handicapping factor. The point that there's so much room for opportunism, there's so much room for capitulation to the whims of the U.S. ruling elite. And of course, given the fact, as already noted, that the country was founded upon class collaboration between richer and poorer Europeans, to the point where that class collaboration has been so normalized, it's become virtually invisible to the naked eye, even of certain analysts who consider themselves to be radical and progressive. And so that may, and I underline may, be on the verge of changing, but it's unclear. And let me tease out this point a bit more, if I have a second. And that is that given this crisis in the United States right now, this internecine factionalism within the U.S. ruling elite over the current occupant of the Oval Office, the current occupant of the Oval Office has overwhelming support within his political party, the Republican Party, which is the party of whiteness. And he has significant support still amongst that 63 million strong base of Euro-Americans within the Republican Party. The anti-Trump faction of the U.S. ruling elite will have to do what they have not been prone to do in order to defeat Mr. Trump, which is really to develop a rainbow coalition, since they don't have a majority amongst the population defined as white. Now, the problem there is, number one, many of the analysts, even so-called white progressives, you know, somehow that basic elementary political fact escapes them. Number two, if you look at the history of liberalism in the United States of America, which, of course, was a major target for Martin Luther King in the 1960s, that is to say, white liberalism, you'll see that it has very deep and uninterrogated roots in the United States of America. That is to say, there were two factions that formed this country that were at war with one another. One was the pro-slavery faction, symbolized by Washington, concluding with Jefferson Davis in the 1860 Civil War. And the other is the white man's country faction, which thought that this country should be denuded of Negroes. I just made reference to that with regard to the U.S. Civil War. When slavery was abolished in Vermont in the 1770s, it was not so much to get rid of slavery, it was to get rid of the Negroes. When Oregon entered the Union in the 1850s, there were no Negroes allowed, and not allowed until the 1920s, which is one of the reasons why Portland, as a city, has one of the smallest black populations in the United States of America. Now, you have these liberal anti-Trumpers who need to build a rainbow coalition to defeat Trump. I'm speaking just of the ruling class now, not the working class or the middle class. And yet they're heirs to an ideology that was grounded on the United States being a white man's country. That's going to be a very difficult square to circle, although there may be signs that there is an attempt to square this circle. I would have to make a big leap in order to find evidence. But since this is progressive radio, I'll put a big toe in the water. And that is, to speak on what everybody's speaking about, how do you explain the fact that Robert Iger of Disney, who, of course, has expressed anti-Trump sentiments, was willing to commit $450 million in production and promotion costs in producing this film, Black Panther? I don't know if you've seen it, but in any case, it's taking the country by storm. It's eroding a central canard of Hollywood, which is you shouldn't spend money on black movies because they don't make money. They don't travel well abroad, which always has been fallacious, but now has exploded. Is it possible to suggest, and this is where I'm putting my big toe in the water, that in order to understand this internecine conflict within the various factions of the U.S. ruling elite, that the anti-Trump faction might decide to make certain concessions to the most reliable anti-Trump vote, which is the black vote, which voted against him 9-1, which would therefore help to shed light on $450 million spent on Black Panther? Now, don't have your listeners throw raspberries at me. I know I'm engaging in speculation. I haven't looked at Disney's emails and haven't read through their records. But still, I think the point is worth putting out there nonetheless.
Ideology takes center stage in practically everything you've written. The ideology is decidedly left and unapologetic. Why do you not contain yourself when you produce a historical record and say, okay, this is just the facts, ma'am, and then you make of it whatever you will in terms of your own ideological perspective? Why is it important to you that your work markedly reflect an ideological reference, point of reference?
Well, if you look at the histories that have survived, I think of Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, for example, and I had the great honor to have known Walter Rodney. If you look at Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery, for example, the founding father of modern Trinidad and Tobago, as you know better than most. If you look at the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, who I wrote my first book about, particularly the suppression of the African slave trade, which was one of, which was his first book. You'll see a connective tissue amongst these works and their writers, that is the connective tissue being a critique of settler colonialism in the Americas, a critique of slavery, an analysis that suggests that capitalism itself was built upon a towering cadavers, a towering mountain of cadavers, of bodies of enslaved Africans, and that there are certain inferences that you can draw from that very unpleasant recitation of facts. Now, of course, I'm willing to concede that that is a kind of left-wing analysis, but I think more than that, it's an analysis that's based upon reality. I mean, it's an analysis that's based upon not whitewashing the past. It's an analysis that hopefully leads us to develop a strategy to dig ourselves out of the deep hole in which we find ourselves. And perhaps that is what helps to separate historians who are designated as left-wing from others, because as noted, many mainstream historians pride themselves on being ignorant of the present. They pride themselves in sticking to their knitting and only debating and discussing their topics, such as production of blue shoestrings in 16th century France, for example. So I'll accede to your descriptor as being a left-wing analyst, as long as we understand the full meaning of what that descriptor entails.
Well, that is my point exactly. I mean, I'm not using it as a pejorative. I'm using it as a rare example of clarity on the part of the historian. You are not a dispassionate observer of history. You're in it. And you see yourself in it many times in your writings. You can tell that the passion comes from the identification by you of the travails that people have had to suffer and go through at the hands of the ruling elite. And you make no apologies about that. Now, that means to me that you kind of lost your sense somewhere along the line, because you could have gone the route of applying your brilliance and your thoroughgoing research to works that would have made you a lot of money and given you nice fat fees and underwriting by major foundations and the like. Why did you make the choice to say, I'm not going to pretend I'm being dispassionate about this? I have a vested interest, and it also concerns me because I'm part of the group disproportionately affected.
Well, fortunately, as I was coming to maturity, there was a movement, not only domestically, but more importantly, globally. An anti-colonial movement in Africa, a movement towards socialism worldwide, and that made it possible for me to try to stand on the shoulders of that movement so that I could see further. And if I had been born perhaps a century earlier, I would not have had the opportunity to do so. And in fact, if I had tried to say things about slavery that I'm saying now in the 21st century, I might have been on the wrong end or the business end of a lyncher's rope. So it's difficult for me to even explain myself to you or to others, or even explain myself to myself without understanding these broader historical trends and the fact that because of the sacrifice of so many, past and present, it's allowed myself and others to do the kind of work that we do. And hopefully there are younger generations, and I am sure that there are younger generations who are coming up who will be able to build upon what myself and some of my peers have tried to construct, and therefore will move the ball further down the field, unless, of course, the 45th president decides to blow up the planet in a moment of resentment and pique.
As he's particularly susceptible to peaks. 888-874-4888 is the number to call and engage in some dialogue with our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, historian par excellence, and we're very, very fortunate, all of us, for the work that he does and the way he does it. Gerald, of the books that you've written, if, let's say, because I always encourage people to start their own library, what would you consider to be the must-have books that you have written that would give people a starting point in understanding Black history?
Well, I mean, that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, it's almost asking which one is your favorite child, for example. That's how you help to keep therapists employed for years to come. But having said that, I mean, I'd have to say the 1776 book, because it goes into the origins of this present so-called superpower. And I think as well it sheds light on the ideological weaknesses of those who have not been able to see what is, to me, crystal clear, that this founding of the United States was no Greek leap forward for humanity. It may have been a Greek leap forward for certain Europeans. And it was a devastation for the indigenous population and the African population. Now, I just got my hands on my latest book last night, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, which is a precursor to the 1776 book. And it deals with the origins of colonial settlement in North America in the 1600s. You might have noticed my reference to that sprinkled throughout our conversation. And thumbing through this book, as I've been doing for a few minutes this morning, I think that ultimately this may come to be the book I would point to answer your question. But since I only got my hands on this last night, it would be premature to say that as of today.
We have a question from Noel from Brooklyn. You're on the air.
Your guest. I wanted to mention something. I'm calling from New York City, and I just wanted to know both Utrice and your guest, Mr. Horn. I'm calling from New York City, and as you know, Utrice, there was a committee set up by Mayor Bill de Blasio about Christopher Columbus. And, of course, we know what kind of individual he was and the whole bit. And I feel that either the governor, who wanted Christopher Columbus to stay at Columbus Circle and the other statues, either he's misinformed, an idiot, or racist. I wanted to know your opinion on that.
Well, it possibly could be all three. But you have to understand, as a sage once said, that it's very difficult to get a person to accede to a particular reality when his salary, career, and fortune is based on denying that reality. Mm-hmm. And therein, you see the dilemma in confronting the cutthroat that was Christopher Columbus. Once again, I think it's important to move beyond the individual to, say, the 63 million strong Trump base. That is to say that it's possible that both Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio have reason to feel that if they were to do the right thing and rename Columbus Circle and take down the statue, that there would be a rebellion of a certain sector of the electorate in Staten Island and Queens and certain parts of Brooklyn and Manhattan, and they would lose their jobs. Maybe they don't want to lose their jobs.
But the truth about it is, and I'm not trying to be funny, let's say we were going to call it Utrice Lead Circle or Gerald Horn Circle. You guys haven't killed anybody. You guys haven't enslaved anybody. So why not?
Well, actually, I think that Gerald Horn Circle has a nice ring to it, to be frank with you.
How about Utrice and Gerald Horn Circle?
but once again,
Noel, the point is, and I think Gerald has made this very clear, these kinds of decisions do not occur in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And the judgment first and foremost is, how will my base react? Not only the one that I have, but a future base.
How so am I naive to say, let's about the truth?
Action?
Utrice, am I naive enough to say, let's forget about the truth and let's work? Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm saying that we have to be realistic about how decisions are made that are of an intrinsically political nature. The people who you would like to, you would like them to understand, the humanity of such a decision, the logic of such a decision. But if they do not enhance the decision maker's power base and political influence, then that's the basis on which decisions are made. We believe all the time that all we have to do is to demand it. Demand a thing, and it should happen because it's moral and just and right. We seldom factor in the political reality of how decisions are made. And if you come to a demand like this without political power, then you're just spitting in the wind.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to take any more time.
You have to come to a decision like that and to press your point with documented political clout, with the ability to inflict punishment if they don't go along with your plan. Thanks, Noel, for your call. Jamila from Louisiana, you are on the air.
Yep, Sister Utrice and Dr. Horn and the listening audience.
Thank you so much.
A great program today. It's so good to hear Dr. Horn's voice again. I just wanted to acknowledge the passing of the great historian Lerone Bennett, Jr., and to get some comments from Dr. Horn about Dr. Lerone Bennett, Jr.
Thank you.
Lerone Bennett Jr. was born approximately 89 years ago in Clarksdale, Mississippi. He was a proud alumnus of Morehouse College, but was catapulted to prominence as a result of his long-term association with the Johnson Publishing Empire in Chicago, where he eventually moved, and particularly Ebony Magazine. His premier work was Before the Mayflower, which is, I guess you'd call, a narrative history of the presence of Africans in North America. He infuriated and inflamed the historians' establishment, and indeed a good deal of the U.S. ruling elite, with his book, Forced into Glory, a critique of Abraham Lincoln, which he correctly said. Lincoln was basically a representative of the white man's country faction, which oftentimes has been called the anti-slavery faction, but it was anti-slavery because they just wanted to get rid of the Negroes altogether. And then he was forced into glory as a result of losing the Civil War up until about 1862-63, which leads to the Emancipation Proclamation. And then in 1864, 1865, when he seems to be bending to reality and wanting to not deport the Negroes, he's been killed. It's very interesting. In his obituary in the New York Times just a few days ago, usually in obituaries, part of the custom in the United States, you try to say nice things about people after they pass away so they don't have the opportunity to respond. Signaling the continuing fury and outrage of his critique of Lincoln, this mythical, mythological figure, they cited critiques of his book on Lincoln from the historical establishment. And indeed, if you go into C-SPAN, c-span.org, you can find a remarkable talk by Lerone Bennett at the Schomburg Library some years ago after that book came out, where I'm afraid to say that the Schomburg surrendered and invited a panel to critique Bennett's book about Lincoln just after he presented. Usually when you have a book signing or speaking in your book, you don't invite critics to then flame you after you finish speaking. Obviously, Lerone Bennett touched a sensitive nerve, which is why we will continue to be discussing him and his very long and productive career for years and decades to come.
Thank you. Tom from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Tom,
are you?
Yes. You have it?
Yes, you're here, and we're hearing you.
Very nice. Okay. The last time you were on the show with Eutrice, I had emailed her afterwards. And in the scope of your knowledge and study of history of popular movements, is there anything that has not been undermined by corruption and greed once the people that thought they were doing more for the people got into power?
Oh, sure. I mean, look, unfortunately, societies are built by imperfect human beings. Oftentimes, they're built by agglomerations of imperfect human beings. And so we should not be surprised if their products and constructions are somehow imperfect. But having said that, and as I've indicated a few moments ago, without buying into this typical U.S. myth of continuous virtuous progress, I don't think I'd be here talking as a person of African descent in North America unless there had been continuous and unselfish struggle by millions that preceded me. As we speak, I'm putting the finishing touches on a book on the liberation of Southern Africa. And you cannot begin to understand the liberation of Southern Africa without understanding the role of the Cuban government, which dispatched tens of thousands of their finest sons and daughters to that part of Africa to defeat the apartheid army on the battlefield, threatening to march on Pretoria and forcibly eject the masters of apartheid, which induced in the masters of apartheid sweet reason, causing them to negotiate, leading to elections in 1994. Now, of course, since 1994, there has been progress in South Africa, and of course, there's been disappointment too. But I dare say that the overthrow of apartheid was a step forward for humanity, and we would not be able to progress in the 21st century in Southern Africa, and I would say in the entire Pan-African world, but for the overthrow of apartheid in which the Cuban troops played a leading role.
Well,
and that, would be
that brings us to... Tom, we're up against the clock. I'm getting signals.
Okay.
It's time to go. I want to thank you so much, Gerald, for the work you do. I say this a lot because in every important field that we can imagine, important to our continued progress and liberation eventually, we desperately need good soldiers, and you are one of them. And I want to thank you for the work you have already done and the work you continue to do. And I thank you for being with us today. I want to explore if you can fit us into another round of discussion. I want to get specific about your books and to encourage people to begin a library, your own personal library, and some books are absolutely necessary to have. So thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
All righty. Stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN.FM, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.